This is a part of the Inquiring Minds series, which is a speakers bureau, which is sponsored by the Washington Commission for the Humanities and is made possible through the National Endowment for the Humanities. And so we acknowledge their help in making this program possible this evening and ask you to please support them. Tonight, you are going to meet William Shakespeare, or Will. This evening, you are going to travel back in time. So cast your mind back. The date is June 26th, 1615. We are in Stratford, in England, at the home of the Shakespeare family. Will will be out in just a few moments, and he will be speaking for a short time, just any thoughts that might be on his mind. And then he's going to invite you to ask questions of him. Now, it's important when you ask your questions that you remember that Will Shakespeare has no knowledge of any contemporary issues. He also wanted me to remind you that this is not just a discussion this evening of the plays that he has written. You are free to write to ask him about the social conditions, about political issues of the time, the plague. It's all open game. Just please keep in mind that we are in the year 1615. And we would like to ask you one more favor. The Washington Commission for the Humanities, in order to continue to improve the quality of their program, asked the audience that they would fill out an evaluation form on the program. So I would like to hand these out and pass around some pencils.
I trust you've not been waiting long, huh? Anne has just now told me you were here. My dear wife Anne, huh? Happy, she says, but for me, huh? Well, no matter. Today, you are most welcome in my home. I have lived here in Stratford again these past 7 years, huh? Since my illness brought me here again. 7 years. 7 years. I must have this stick at my side to go comfortably from place to place. Times are I find myself in some place and cannot recollect why I've come there. I'm better. Yeah, but I grow old. I've been out walking in the garden. It is a great pleasure of mine here in Stratford. It causes me to think on growing old, to see these things spring from the earth and die again. And I grow old. I have seen many springs bring new life. And as I look at your faces, I see some that have seen perhaps more springs than I have seen. Yeah, and I grow old. I have a moist eye, dry hand, a yellow cheek, a white beard, a decreasing leg, the increasing belly. My voice is broken, my wind is short, my chins are double, my wit is single. Every part about me blasted with antiquity. To what end? To what purpose do we suffer these slings and arrows, if not to nurse the life with honor wealth and ease in waning age. Honor, wealth, ease, and the company of good friends. Welcome to my home. There. 7 years, I say, that I have been here in Stratford, away from London. I was there for 20 more years, you see, working daily in the theater. I am pleased to be here. This is the place for me at this time in my life. But I must confess that there are times that I miss that London and the activity of the theater. I am still a shareholder in the Globe Theater and in the King's Men, huh? And I receive my income as a shareholder in that company. And I wonder, since I am here in Stratford, if they are doing things right, huh? It seems that my share is not so large as it must be. Well, I have a friend, John Hemmings. He has been a close friend and fellow player for more than 20 years, and he still goes to the theater each day, and he writes me letters, and he tells me what is about there. And today, I have received a letter from John, and he tells me today that King James has once again asked to see Macbeth. This is wonderful, huh? Indeed. It's King James, our sovereign king. He commands that we must all be Protestant, which I am sure we all are, huh? Indeed. James himself is something of a Calvinist, much given to belief in witches and spirits and demons, huh? Macbeth, he says again. This play, this Macbeth, it was written at the request of James to be performed in honor of a visit by his brother-in-law, King Christian of Denmark, a brother to our Queen Anne. This visit, this was to last 1 week. It turned to 3 due to the Danish king's appetite for English ale. It is said that had he not left when he did, there would have been no ale left whatsoever in all of England. I am pleased to see him gone. No matter. James says we must have a new play in honor of this visit to be performed here at court. And could it be a Scottish play? James says, ah. And so I write Macbeth for this. And that visit, those evenings, along with the ale, there was entertainment. And on one such evening, we were in the midst of Macbeth, and we had come to the witches' parts. I myself played one of those witches' parts in that first performance, and I remember it well. We have no women in our company, and all the parts must be performed by the men and boys. And so it fell to me that night to portray a witch's part. I remember it well. We had come to those witches' lines. Round about the cauldron go, in the poisoned entrails throw, fillet of a fenny snake in the cauldron boil and bake, eye of newt and toe of frog, wool of bat and tongue of dog, adder's fork and blindworm's sting, lizard's leg and howlet's wing, scale of dragon, tooth of wolf, witch's mummy, maw and gulf of the ravenous salt sea shark, root of hemlock digged in the dark, livers of blasphemers too, gall of goat, and slips of ewe slivered in the moon's eclipse, nose of Turk and Tartar's lips, and a finger of a birth-strangled babe, ditch delivered by a drab, make the gruel thick and slab, for a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth, boil and bubble. And at that very moment, King James rose from his chair, clapped his hands, and shouted, "Excellent! Excellent!" And then, leaning forward, he added gravely, "That is most truly how they make their evil magic. I have seen such sights myself as a boy in my native Scotland." And then, most curious, all the lords in attendance nodded and murmured, as if they too had seen such sights. "Yeah, but let us hear more of this play," says James. And with that command, there was silence. We could begin again. Such a night I shall not forget. God must be praised that our king is not a Puritan. Or our sovereign queen before him, Or as surely as there is a God in heaven, there would be no plays in England. I have read their pamphlets and heard their sermons, You too, perhaps. What is the cause of plague, they ask? The cause of plague is sin. And what is the cause of sin, they ask? The cause of sin are plays. Close the theaters, end the plague, They would loose this nonsense on our land in the name of God. They would... You would do well to not let me be free to speak of these Puritans, or you shall hear of nothing else all evening, I think. I shall say one more thing of them, and then on to other more pleasant matters, perhaps. I am told that these Puritans find great hope in this place they call the New World. If this is true, then it is my most fervent hope that every last Puritan would board ship and sail to that new world. Let there be no plays there. We shall have our plays here in England. Indeed. Anne says I am a man of too many words. Perhaps she speaks the truth at times. But before you grow weary with all this sitting and listening, I am told that perhaps you have some questions for me, Who would begin?
Why are there no women in your troop?
Well, it is not only our troop, it is our land, This England. Do you know that there are women on the stage in all other civilized countries of Europe, and in France, in Italy, the seat of the Pope, In Germany, in the Netherlands, in all places where there is theater, there are women on the stage. Only here in England is this not the case. It is the Puritans. They do this to me, I think. This is perhaps not the truth. It is tradition, I think. I hope that it will end. I have written in my plays parts for women as fine and great as the parts for men. And we have most skillful boys in our company to act these parts, but it is still not as it should be. And I write these parts in the hope, the hope that someday, and that I might see this, that someday women will take their place on our stage. They are as needed and important there as they are in our lives. And it is not right that we have theater without them.
You have problems with plagiarism, Will.
Do I? No, I have no problems with it. You know Robert Greene, perhaps? This playwright, of some years ago. Plagiarism, indeed. Greene had written a play called Harry the Sixth. It was received with great enthusiasm by the audiences. But this acceptance was not owing to the play's fine qualities. It was due to a hunger in our land, a hunger born of the military victories and national pride of the time, a hunger for stories of our English past, and they would see anything that was put on a stage. And Greene had written this play, and, well, I was asked by the Earl of Pembroke, whose company I was a part of at that time, if I might make a new play for their men, an English play. And it seemed that this Harry VI was a good start. And so I took it upon myself to write a play that followed in time Greene's play. Huh? Greene, however, took great offense at this. I think that he was most bothered by the fact that the audiences thought my play to be better than his. Huh? Yeah, but he died some 6 months later, bloated with his final meal of pickled herring and Rhenish wine, surrounded by the filth and stench of his lice-infested room. And after he died, Henry Chettle, a printer, published Greene's last writing, A Groat's Worth of Wit, it was called, filled with unkind words for many. But the unkindest cut of all was aimed at the poor players, and at one poor player in particular. An upstart crow, he said, beautified by stolen feathers. A tiger's heart, he said, wrapped in a player's hide. One who, in spite of his lack of university training, thought himself able to bombast out blank verse as fine as his betters, thought himself, in fact, to be the only Shakespeare in the country. This says Greene, but I did not steal his play. Not I. But the plays of Plautus and Seneca, now I will take those, and make my use of them. Now I have no problem with this.
Sir, your thoughts on the king and queen?
James and Anne, huh? I have few thoughts of Anne. I see her rarely. James is Anne. I have thoughts of my Anne. What shall I say of James? He is a most complex man. This is a man who believed so strongly that these English people should have a Bible that they could read in their own words, that he made this Bible happen, and he has earned his place in heaven for this, I think. It is a most marvelous thing that he has done. But this is also a man who is proud to swear that he has never bathed in his entire life. Well, this is a fact which few can doubt. He is most complex. I spoke earlier of his belief in witches and spirits, and this is most true in his heart. He believes these things with all his will. Has written books explaining witchcraft and demonology. What is there else to say of James? He loves plays so well that when he became king, he says, I must have my own company of players, and they must be the finest company in all the land. Well, this was our company, of course. We were the Lord Chamberlain's men. And James says that the Chamberlain find some other company. These shall be the king's men. And we have played more times in court for James in those few years since he became king than we did in all of the years that Elizabeth was queen, and she loved plays herself, but James cannot get enough of them. Oh, I cannot say ill of a man who loves plays. He is a fine king. He has had difficulties, He means well. He will not be the leader of our land that Elizabeth was. Perhaps this is the times. But he is a friend, and he honors us with his choice of his company. And so I speak well of him.
Sir, you said that Green accused you of not having a university education. Your plays are full of so much wonderful history and myth. How did you get so much information to put into your plays?
There is truly very little in my plays that I have not seen or heard in my life. We live in a most wonderful and exciting time. There is knowledge around us in all forms. And I am flattered by your belief that my plays are filled with these fine things. I believe, in fact, that my lack of university training is the single most important thing in the quality of my plays. I am not the only playwright in England. In fact, I am not even the finest these days. My plays are falling out of favor with the audiences, and others like Ben Jonson and Beaumont and Fletcher take their places now and write a new kind of play that I have no desire to write. But all of these writers that I have known that have all spent time at the university, Green being one, a graduate of both Oxford and Cambridge, most all the alehouses of London, I think. They are taught to write plays in a most confined manner. And all their plays seem to look alike. Mine do not look as theirs. And this is because I did not learn those rules and was not told that this is the way to make a play. I began as an actor. And so when I make a play, it is as an actor making it. This is as it should be, I think. I have the advantage also of knowing in each case what men will play what parts. In each play that I write, this company that we have has had the same group of men for near to 20 years now, and this is a great benefit to me to know that Burbage will play this part and Kemp will play this part, and I can make these things fit my men and their skills, and because of that, I think my plays have served well.
I think they may last. I think they may last.
Well, you are kind.
What was the illness that caused you to move to Stratford?
I must honor the hand here.
Forsooth. Your plays show such depth of understanding of the human heart, particularly the darker, violent heart of men and women today. Perhaps you have a comment to make about that great trial going on right now of Sir O.J. Simpson.
Living here in Stratford as I do, I am not aware of the things that you speak of. These must be happenings of London now.
Some large city.
Perhaps after our visit you might tell me more of these things. I think. I would say a thing about your comment that the plays are filled with, what did you say, darkness?
Insight into the darker corners of the heart.
There is great evil in our land, and in our world, and it is always with us. And some say it is witches and demons. Some say it is simply the way men are. Whatever the name one gives to it, it is a driving force at times in our lives, something that we must reckon with. And I do not write these plays to shed a good light on on these things, but to be honest, and to show life as it is. What is on our stage must be what is in our streets, in a finer form, perhaps, and with finer words and a greater sense of grandeur and power, but the same human beings behaving in the same ways, and I've seen much evil. Do you know that in our lifetimes, Tyburn Gallows has run red with the blood of priests? First hung, and then cut down to lie stunned, while with one swift stroke, the executioner guts them like a new-killed deer. Cuts out the still-beating heart, that the priest might see it as he breathes his last. And this in the name of God. There is much evil. And so we find it on the stage. It would be wrong to make plays that did not have it. But I have made many plays where this is not the main thing, so you must acknowledge this as well. But as to this other issue, perhaps another time we can discuss this.
Yes, what roles did you play in these plays that you wrote? You said you wrote for certain actors, and you took some roles yourself.
I have been a player, you know, in most all the plays that I have written. But this is the largest house in all of Stratford, the grandest home in our town. If I had had to rely on my skills as an actor to make my living, there would be room for only 5 or 10 of you in this house, and not for all. I am not a fine actor. I love it dearly, and it is what brought me to London, and what brought me to the theater, and I shall never forget it, but it was not where my true talents lay, and that I soon discovered. And I'm pleased that I found this writing of plays, or I would still be an actor, But the parts that I played were not large. I played Adam, I played Hamlet's father, the ghost. If you would wish to know the parts that I have played, in most cases, it is the first male who speaks in each play, and this is the part for me. So you might look through those and answer your own question now.
What was the illness that caused you to move from London?
Do you like to listen to people speak of their physical ailments? How much shall I say? We could spend all evening. I could tell you all of the things that are wrong and have been all these years. A brief answer, perhaps. I do not know a name for it. My daughter Susanna's husband, John, is a fine physician here in Stratford, and he and Susanna cared for me when I was brought here, and he does not have a name. Some sort of fit, perhaps, he says. Like Caesar's falling sickness, he says. It is difficult to explain this without telling more of the story. It was a year, a winter of great cold in London. The coal fires burned for months on the ice of the Thames, and it did never thaw. December brought the plague to London. On the 31st, my brother Edmund was buried in St. Saviour's Churchyard near the Globe. The earth frozen so deep it required an extra 10 shillings to the grave diggers. 20 shillings more, bought a forenoon knell of the great bell, and it was done. Edmund Shakespeare, player, apprentice to the King's men, come to London only a year before. on the strength of such wind as scatters young men through the world to seek their fortunes farther than at home, where small experience grows. May not young men die as well as old. January was colder. February, the same. The theaters all closed. When the death count of the plague reaches 200 weekly, the Privy Council closes all theaters and other places of gathering. With the theaters closed, there was no reason to stay in London, and I resolved to leave for Stratford, and only my reluctance to face 4 days on horseback in an icy wind kept me to my room and fire. And then word came from home, from Susanna and John, the birth of Elizabeth. This news of a first grandchild, this thawed my heart. And I resolved then to leave for Stratford. And next morning, in bitter cold and fog, I urged my horse out from the shelter of his stable through chilling fog toward Stratford. It was my custom, as I traveled from London to Stratford, to stop and rest at Oxford, it being about halfway. That evening, I had shared fine food and drink and good conversation. And I was weary and anxious for a bed and quiet dreams. And I said my goodbyes, and I rose from the table. So sudden it was, like a candle being snuffed out in my mind. This leg crumbled beneath me as if it were turned to dust, and my arm would not reach out for the chair, and I fell to the floor and lay silent and staring. Faces crowded round. Mistress Davenant cried, "God's wounds, Will, what is it?" "Too much ale," another voice said. And I wondered why I could not get up, why they could not seem to understand. My confusion was soon stilled by a deep sleep, broken only seldom as I rode the next 2 days, propped in the back of an Oxford carrier's wagon, jolting through frozen ruts, delivered here to Stratford in the care of Susanna and Dr. Hall. Months passed. I could not think or speak clearly. I could not walk a stage, or write a line or play a part. Made lame by fortune's dearest spite. Just and proper payment for your sins. That was what my dear Anne said. God had acted, nothing could be done. Well, I did. This is a good story. I did begin to recover. The Bishop of Holy Trinity Church here in Stratford heard that I was recovering and came one day to visit me. He said how good it was to see me looking better. Wished God's continued blessing for me. Said he hoped to see me soon at worship. This was a time that thoughts that seemed to me not mine came from my mouth. I looked at him and I said, "You foul and greasy, wine-sodden whoreson!" As the vicar's mouth fell open, Susanna hurried him from the room before another word could be spoken by either of us. Next day, a message from the vicar arrived, saying that until I was more completely myself again, my continued absence at worship would be excused without fine. It was late in fall that I found that the candle was burning bright again, and that I could think clearly again. dear Mercy, this illness was. And I did not see it then. But this is what it was. This brought me home here to Stratford, to my family and my friends, after 20-some years of being away from them. So this was God's mercy, not his payment.
Your play, Pericles, did you write it all?
It is odd that you ask this at this time. This was the first play that I attempted to write as I recovered from this illness, and it was a play of great difficulty, and I... If I could find each and every copy of this play that exists, I would cause it to disappear. It is not a good play. But this is the cause, I think. I struggled so. Words had come so easily from my pen for years and years, and now they would not flow. And so I struggled with this Pericles sign, and with Cymbeline as well. And then with The Winter's Tale, I found my strength again, and with The Tempest. And this, I thought, is the play to stop with. So I recovered. But this was in the midst of this time, and yes, I did write it. But you may maintain your level of doubt, and as you speak with others, you might say to them, I do not think it was his, it is not good.
How did you like the Globe Theater? What did you like about it? What was your favorite theater?
The Globe is the most wonderful theater in all of England now. And especially now, since it has been rebuilt just in this past year. It burned a year ago. To the ground. Do you know how this happened? I was not there, but I've heard this story. This was a production of Henry VIII, and cannons are fired off back in the Tiring House as the sound of processions. And there is wadding put into the cannons. No cannonballs, but wadding stuffed in. And a piece of this smoldered and lodged in the thatched roof above the Tiring House. And no one noticed this thing. And halfway into the play, fire breaks out all around. This theater, this Globe, as with most other theaters in London, holds near to 2,000 people. Most remarkable that all of the people escaped from the theater. Not a single soul was injured. One man, it is said, came running out with the back of his pants aflame with a flagon of ale, and he's... But this is not injury, I think. It is a most wonderful playhouse, the finest that I have seen. And you ask my favorite. Perhaps I would say The Globe. I have acted in others. We spent most of 15 and more years at the theater, named only that, the first theater built in London, built by Burbage's father. 20 years before, he had built it on leased ground. That land lease expired. I shall tell you this story. It is about the Globe, really. This land lease expired, and the owner of the land, Giles Allen was his name, he had realized by that time that there was great gold to be made by these plays, and that the rent that he was getting for the land was a small pittance compared to the money that was coming in, and he wished, landlords may be, he wished to have more. And so the lease expired, and he offered terms for renewal. And one of those terms was that the playhouse, our playhouse, that Burbage's father had built, that this building would become Allen's property in 5 years' time. We could not accept this. And these negotiations went on for months. One day we were informed that Allen intended to hire a group of men and dismantle the theater. and use its timbers and parts for some better use, he said. What better use could there be than a theater, huh? Well, we could not allow this, and we hired a group of men ourselves and a carpenter, and we went with them to the theater. And there we met this group of Allen's men. And one of them raised his arm into the air, and he said, "By this hand, I command you to leave this place." Henry Condell, my good friend, he raised his arm into the air, and he said, "By this hand, I will supplant some of your teeth." Allen's men, noting that their numbers were not as great as ours, determined that, as is said by Falstaff, I think, that discretion is in fact the better part of valor. Allen's men chose to depart. We set about that very day, dismantled the theater ourselves, ferried those timbers across the Thames to Bankside, and with them we built the Globe. The finest in all of England, huh?
Can, Mr. Shakespeare, up here. Can you recite any favorite lines from either a favorite play or maybe Romeo and Juliet? Do you have any?
I could. For your children. I think not from Romeo and Juliet. Prospero's lines from The Tempest are strong in my mind, and some of those perhaps, but I think that the line that I recall at the moment would better be left for later in our visit, if you would allow. And you will not let me forget, huh?
Okay.
Thank you.
What is your favorite play?
Well, it would be one of mine. There are so many, it is hard to decide, I think. Now, I make light of this. You have children?
Yes.
How many?
Three.
And which is your favorite?
Since two of them are here, I'm going to
I do not wish to make you uncomfortable, but do you see, these plays, they are not children. I have children, but they are like children, and each one in their time has been my favorite time. And then a new one comes, and it takes the attention from the others for a time, and it becomes the favorite time. And if the others lived, they would envy that, I think. And so today, I would say that it is The Tempest. It is most clearly in my mind. It is a play that I still think on, perhaps because I allowed myself a luxury that I have not allowed till then, and that is to make a character in my image. This Prospero is more me than any other character, I think, in any of my plays. There are parts of me and parts of all the people that I know scattered throughout all the plays, but this Prospero, he stands closest to me. And so he is still in my mind, and it is this play that I think of more often. But do you know that I could not bear to think of a world without A Midsummer Night's Dream? This is a play that shall be strong in my mind forever, whatever. An enjoyable play to see and to be in and to be a part of. I was most pleased with that. And there are many others as well, except this Pericles.
Is Puck male or female? Was Puck male or female?
It matters not. He has been both, huh? I think. And perhaps he is both. Perhaps Puck is a she and a he, and together they are Puck. Who else could see the folly of us mortals? He has been played by men in our playhouse, but there is much in Puck that is woman. And I think that the time will come that the woman will play this part, and perhaps better than our men have played. And the same may be said for Ariel.
Can you tell us about some of your friends and if they have appeared in your plays, what relationship they were in the plays? I mean, how did it change, perhaps?
I'm not sure that I... My friends who are acting in the plays?
No, not your acting friends, your friends.
Oh.
And if any of them appear in the plays in a different form,
Anne does not tire of asking me about Kate. Your question is a good one and deserves a better answer than I can give it, but I must say that as I sat down to write these plays, until my illness caused such difficulty, I wrote very rapidly. It is said that I never blotted out a single word that I wrote down. Ben Jonson said I should have blotted thousands. But he is a bricklayer. I say this so that you may understand that these plays came from some place inside of me, as much as from my head. And the use that I might have made of friends and family and acquaintances as the stuff that the characters are made of, this is what you ask.
Yes.
This is not a conscious thing. I draw a character based on things that I know, and I do not think at the moment that, this is from this person or this is from this person. I simply make that character to be as real as I can. But I know that I use parts from all these people, so it would be misleading, I think, perhaps, to answer your question more clearly. I shall say what I have said to Anne, and that is, Kate, I gave you no thought when I wrote Kate. And I would say this to any friend of mine who said, is this me? They are flattered until you say, yes, it is.
Sarah, I've heard you just mentioned Anne. I've heard rumors from a scribe in a rather indiscreet moment, maybe pumped too much full of ale, that in your will, you will leave Anne your second best bed.
Who speaks of these things? Yes, I will. What is it to make a will, to build thy sepulchre and creep into it far before thy time? But Francis Collins, my lawyer, for 3 years now, since my brother Richard's death, he has encouraged me to make my will, peering out from under his bushy eyebrows in his most stern lawyer's voice. He says, Will Shakespeare, you take too little care of this matter, Yeah. Some months passed now. We sat and shared ale and I canary wine. This is a most searching wine. It perfumes the blood. Well, Francis prevailed. I do not know whether it was the persuasion of Francis, now that I think of it, or perhaps the canaries, but... And that day saw my wishes noted and my wealth listed, and Francis says that he shall have this will made for me soon. And Anne has heard of this, that I am doing this, and she has come to me and said, well, this bed of mine, I wish that you would leave to me in the world. It is the only thing. It is the bed that she brought from her father's house when we wed. And it is most special to her. And she has asked that I name this in the will, and I shall do this. But how you would come to know such a thing?
Are you a singer? You have lots of music in your plays. Are you a singer?
If I were to sing, you would not need to ask that question again. The answer would be clear to you, and it would be a no. I love music dearly, and I sing, as we all sing, but I sing when no one else is around. And I think it is to their benefit that I do this. But the plays are filled with music because our people are filled with music, because our land is filled with music, because the English people love song. And I cannot think of a play without song sometime in it. In fact, this new style of play that is gaining such favor in our land, that Ben Jonson is so skilled at writing this play called A Mask, it is mostly music and dance, and not so many words. But I prefer the songs in my plays, and I may sing them quietly to myself at times, but I will not sing them to you.
Sir, yeah? Upon your death, what would you wish for your epitaph?
What I wish? Why do you ask? I shall say, I have not thought of this much, although I must say that making this will and all this talk of wills has caused me to think more of what goes with them, huh? Yeah. I will tell you, I have a great fear. I have a dream that I have had oftentimes, a dream that my final sleep is broken by the tools of the sexton's men come to move uncaring bones to the common yard. And the fear that there be no one there to say, I knew him, when my skull rolls off the sexton's spade. I dream this, and I wake shaking and breathless and palms wet. And so I wish to be buried in the chancel of Holy Trinity Church. And I wish that my bones shall reside there until they are turned to dust. I do not wish that my bones be dug up and moved to the pit. And so if I could say one thing to these people after I am dead, it would be this: leave me where I am.
Sir, my daughter Suzanne would like to know how old you will be in the year 2000.
The way I'm feeling, not much older than I am. Well, it is. These are large numbers. It is 1615. I am 51 in this year, in this past April. I became 51. It is too much for me. You can figure it. 51. I'm weary. It goes late, I think, in this evening. Yes?
Shakespeare, do you consider yourself a religious man?
Our king commands that we be Protestant, and so I am. I've spoken of Tyburn gallows, and things that have been done in the name of God in our land, and this great division in our land between Catholic and Protestant, this has made religion a tool for doing evil. This is not a time. This is most difficult for me. I have been most careful in my plays over all the years to not write of religious things. It causes only dissension. It is also true that in all my years of writing, I was never once arrested. There was no other playwright that I know that can make that claim. One must be somewhat careful as to what one says in plays. You must think that, remember that our purpose in making these plays was to fill the theater, to put gold in our pockets, not to offend our audiences, not to offend our queen, our king, our nobles. Entertain, this is our duty. And so whatever religious beliefs I may hold strongly, they have no place in the plays, I think, not in our time. They can only cause trouble. So to answer your question, it would be probably most fair to say that I have a great belief in God and in Christ my Savior. I have much time for them, but I have little time for religion.
I'd like to ask you something about the skill of playwriting. You seem to have a capacity to speak to both the learned and the uneducated.
You are kind.
How difficult is that? And do you really like the low, the peasant?
The thousand people in the pit.
Yes.
They are half of our audience. Though it costs only a penny to stand in the pit, but they are half of our numbers. And they come to be entertained, and there must be things in each play to reach those people. Just as there must be things in each play to reach those of you who sit in the gallery. I have believed sometimes that those thousand in the pit can appreciate nothing but dumb shows and noise, and that those of you in the galleries wish to hear nothing but wordplay and wit, and that no one has time for a good story, But I do not like you more than them, nor them more than you. But I must give to each of you something to enjoy and to take with you when you leave the theater. And I think that this is what I have tried to do. You are all my audience, and so this writing of plays must reach all of you. I have not found this difficult. I know all of these people. I have sat shoulder to shoulder with each of you. At some time, I know how you speak and what you think. And so, I find some way to satisfy each of you in the plays. Hmm? And have I done this?
Oh, yes.
Ah, then I am successful.